Today's talk is given by Nick Parsons, Special Technologist at Google. His talk is entitled Googling the Future of Spatial. And I should just say that the title, with your permission, the title should probably be blamed upon me. I presented the some cliche titles, and Ed correctly accepted, so any blame for the title should be attributed to me, but hopefully that captures it, we should see. Ed has responsibility for evangelizing Google's mission to organize the world's information using geography. So in this role, he contains links with governments, universities, research and standards organizations, all of which are involved in the development of geospatial technology. He's a member of the board of directors of the Open Geospatial Consortium, OGC, and is co-chair of the W3C/OGC Spatial Data and Web Working Group. He's also a visiting professor at UCL, and also an executive fellow at the University of Aberdeen Business School. And after working for Autodesk in some part of the past, Ed was the first chief technology officer in the 200-year-old history of Gordon Survey, and was instrumental in moving and focusing the organisation from mapping to geographical information. Therefore, as chair professor, can I say that it helps focus on the future of spatial, Ed Parsons.
Thank you very much, Ed. Very smooth, very smooth. And let me say, start off by saying, any time I can do a lecture with a bottle of beer in my hand, it's just brilliant. Only every lecture series works like this. I'm happy, you're happy, everybody's happy. It's great. Okay, Googling the future of spatial. Well, I will do my best. Let me talk a little bit about me first of all. My job really is to be Google's geographer in residence. Most of the people that work at mapping and all of the sort of geo products that we build at Google are computer scientists. There are many of us geographers there, and my job is to be, in many ways, the geographer. And spend most of my time out of the office talking to groups like yourselves, as you heard, government agencies and other people, to provide that interface in and out of Google. I recognize that sometimes Google can seem to be this big, huge, you know, monster organization that it's kind of hard to interact with. Well, my job is to provide that conduit. So if you ever have any problems, any issues, Google me, email me, send me a message on Twitter. I can try and help out. That's really my job. So why is Google interested in geography anyway? Well, it's pretty obvious to those of us that are geographers. This is the first law of geography that was developed by Walter Tober, a famous academic at UCSB. And it seems really obvious. Everything is related to everything else. But near things are more related than distant things. And that truism holds for what we do at Google. Google's mission is to organize the world's information to make it universally accessible and useful. And one of the ways that we can organize information is using geography. If I want to find Starbucks, I obviously am interested in Starbucks that are close to me as opposed to ones that are in Newcastle or Manchester or London. Once upon a time, in the early days of Google, you had to explicitly say, I'm searching for Starbucks in Edinburgh. Now we're clever enough to work out where you are, where all the Starbucks are, join those dots together, and we can use geography to organize things. And that's particularly relevant when you're using your mobile devices, which is the primary way that most of us now interact with the internet. Well over half the searches on Google on a mobile device are about places, they're about locations. This is not if you're using Google Maps, this is just the standard Google search. Over half the time you're searching, you'll be searching for a place. And it's very much embedded into many of the products and services that Google creates, this idea of location. It's obvious in maps, maybe less obvious in other places. Here's an example where it's less obvious. This is Google Inbox. This is my email client. And I'm one of those very strange guys that tries to, by the end of the day, have what's called Inbox Zero, i.e. you have no emails that you haven't dealt with that day. At the end of the day, in Inbox, you get this little sun to say, you know, you've done your job, well done. I cheat to get to Inbox Zero, and by cheating, what I do is take a particular email like this and say, I'm going to hide it until I get to a particular location. So this email is about, I don't know, doing something at home. I'll hide the email message, it disappears from my inbox, and then magically reappears when I get home. If it's about the office or about something I need to do in America, I can hide it until I get to that place, and then suddenly it pops up. So I'm using geography to organise my life. Behind the scenes, there's no map involved. And that's going to be an underlying theme in terms of talking about the future. Increasingly, geo is going to be part of all sorts of activities, but it's not necessarily going to be particularly visible. So, the future. You know, only idiots do lectures about what's going to happen in the future, because you're almost certain to be wrong. There is no such thing as divination, okay? You can look as much as you like in your crystal ball, and you can make vague attempts at trying to recognise what's going to happen in the future, but it's very difficult. I honestly, last year, put a bet on the American presidential election. And my bet was that President Trump wouldn't win a single state. Why are you even listening to me? But I'm going to try. Okay, some mega trends, some things that are so big they're going to impact on most of our lives and will have some impact in geo, obviously. The first is this one, and this is really interesting, I think. Increasingly, we are going to live in much more dense urban societies than we have done in the past. It's just more economical, it's more efficient that we live in denser cities where we can make use of public transport, it's easier to generate and supply electricity in smaller footprints. We are going to end up in cities that are more like Tokyo than Los Angeles. And if you think about how many of the tools and services that we use every day develop, they developed in that kind of American Californian model where everyone drives around and the car is the primary mode of transport. You know, we live in a suburban world if you take many of those services for granted. But actually, increasingly, that's not going to be the case. And you'll see some small changes. Even if you look at Google Maps in the last 2 weeks, we've changed the way that we render maps. We've changed the cartographic style to de-emphasize roads because they're less and less important to many of our users. Many of our users are pedestrians. They use public transport, they cycle. Roads will no longer be dominant. We will be urban rather than suburban. We are obviously digital natives. Now, I think probably most of the people in this room will be classed as a digital native. You can't remember a time before the internet. You can't remember when you just couldn't go online and get access to whatever information you wanted. And to be able to compare different products and services very quickly and choose the one that you want. If you're developing new products, you have to appreciate that there's going to be a kind of a high bar of expectation with digital natives. Big data, everyone talks about big data. We are clearly collecting loads and loads of volumes of data, both structured and unstructured. What's going to be interesting is where the real value is. I and many people believe the value is not actually in the data itself, it's those people that can manipulate the data will hold the real value. In many cases, the data becomes the commodity. It's the processing of the data where the real value is generated. And we'll focus in some examples of that later on. The other big trend, particularly from a technology point of view, is platforms. And clearly here, we don't mean platforms at railway stations. We mean platforms that allow you to develop products and services online very, very easily using things like APIs, using Amazon Web Services. Things that allow a company like Uber to start up in a year without having to build any of their own infrastructure. They were able to build on top of other companies' services, data, machines, access to location-based technology that they didn't have to develop themselves. They could build on top of that. Here's a big term, disintermediation. The idea that you remove an element of a product or of a service chain that actually isn't adding very much value. And the classic example of disintermediation is the travel agent. I can still remember going into a travel agent to book a holiday. You went in, you sat at a desk, and you spoke to someone, and they would book an airline ticket by phoning somebody up and sending faxes and the rest of it to get hotels. Now we just go online directly with the airline, the hotel, and we book. We don't need travel agents anymore because we can all do that more efficiently. You'll see more and more of this as other parts of a service chain get removed if they're not really adding any value. Most of those things about technology, this is not a social issue and perhaps as a result more difficult to deal with. Horstner's carriage thinking relates back to the Locomotive Act of 1901, where the government required owners of horseless carriages to hire a man with a red flag to walk in front of the carriages to limit the speed. To limit the speed to less than 4 miles an hour in the City of London. So they didn't want these horseless carriages going too fast. They wanted them to act like horse carriages. Didn't want that progress to be too disruptive. Well, I'm pleased to say the average speed in London is still about 4 miles an hour. So that clearly worked. But no, you know, the reality here is it's very hard sometimes when a technology comes along that disrupts the status quo. Often, the powers that be, the vested interests, will try to introduce this horseless carriage thinking. It can happen and it can work in the short term, but if the technology is truly disruptive, it will disrupt. You can't avoid the inevitable. Okay, so those are my big trends. I'm reasonably confident about those. Here's a near future that's more specific to geo. So this is stuff that actually is really happening now, and it may only be happening in relatively small areas, i.e. with small market acceptance. But it's going to grow, it's going to become more mainstream. So this is my view of the near future. And I'm going to deal with three particular topics. Favourite one of mine is the idea of ambient location. Then I'm going to talk about the new realities, i.e. ways that we can represent the world around us. And then finally talk about the impact of machines, cloud computing and machine learning. And that's really what I'm going to focus on, nothing more. So ambient location. Ambient location started here with the introduction of the iPhone. Told you always start search for Starbucks. Have to.
Starbucks. I'm going to search for Starbucks, and sure enough, there's all the Starbucks. Now,
you get some rainbow
clouds. I can get a list of Starbucks here, if I pick that one if I want, and I can even go look at that Starbucks, and there it is, and let's give a call.
Search for this on YouTube and watch it. That's the best hour that you can spend of a showman selling snake oil. Because at the time, that was mostly fake. You know, that phone didn't actually work as a phone. The first iPhone, if you remember, 10 years ago, didn't have a GPS. You had to tell it where you were to search for things. But why this demo is so important and why it captured people's imagination is it changed maps from being something that was static that you looked at just looked at, to something that you could interact with. You could search for things that weren't on the map, that suddenly appeared when you expressed an interest, and you could then interact. You could say, oh, I actually want to dial the number of that Starbucks, or as we now look into the future, lots of other things. It turned maps from being static to interactive, to be gateways to other types of information. And that's so crucial, because today, applications like Google Maps are one of the four or five products that we have that have over a billion users. That's about half of the internet will be using Google Maps. They'll be using it to avoid the traffic, to look at real-time information provided by other users of Google Maps that are updating the traffic information globally every 30 seconds. So if there's an accident, Google Maps will let you know before almost anyone else knows. It will get you home using public transport systems, again linking in to real-time information provided by public sector agencies like TfL or RATP in Paris. It will allow you to book restaurants. It will allow you now to see how busy the restaurants are. It will show you a graph telling you how many people are in the restaurant at this point in time and whether you're likely to need a reservation or not. And perhaps most important and fundamentally change the way that we live our lives is it means that you'll never be lost. You'll always have that little blue dot in your application telling you where you are. Now, of course, if you want to get lost, you can switch it off. Don't think about it. But imagine the confidence that it brings you. Wherever you may travel, you can always pull out your phone and you'll always know where you are. That's a huge difference. Probably most of you here don't remember ever being lost because you've always had that phone in your pocket. Being lost is not nice. It's a horrible feeling. Actually having that level of confidence is quite empowering. Now, what I'm going to talk to you next about this idea of ambient location requires a level of trust in a service provider, whether it's Google or Apple or Amazon, whoever else. Because for ambient location, this idea of knowing where things are and where you are in relation to those all the time requires a level of data sharing. In this case, you need to log into your Google account and share some information with Google. For that to work, we recognize the fact that you have to be in complete control. You have to be able to switch that off and say, I don't want to play anymore. I want to remove all of that information so you know nothing about me. And that really is the kind of industry best practice. And if you do choose to share information, the map suddenly becomes egocentric. It's about you. You are the center of the map now. Once upon a time, the center of the map was always Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was the most important thing. Now we are the center of each of our own individual maps. And each map that we generate now for Google Maps, each time you look at the map, if you're logged in, it's your map. It's customized to you as an individual. It allows you to do services like this. This is what appears on your smartwatch as you're walking along the platform at St. Pancras. It pops up. And it tells you about your reservation just about to get on the train to Paris. Now, that piece of information is only relevant to you at that location and at that time. It's not relevant half an hour beforehand. You might well be on the underground. You're not worried about it. It's certainly not going to be relevant half an hour later because you will be on the train in the right seat. But at that point in time, that's just what you're looking for. And that's really what we strive to do, to provide you with the information you need as you need it, because we've got that idea of your context. Now, moving on from that, I want you to just focus back on a real birthplace of many technologies that's often kind of hidden, I think, in history. This is the Palo Alto Research Center. It was an organization set up by Xerox, the people that make photocopiers. And they came up with all sorts of different technologies. Much of the technology that appeared in Apple computers came from Xerox PARC. And one of the chief scientists at Xerox PARC, a guy called Mark Weisner, came up with this idea of ubiquitous computing. The idea that everything that we interacted with would become the computer. The most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into the fabric of our lives. It means that these things will eventually disappear. I know that feels shocking now, because we've got such love affairs with these things. They will disappear, because much of the functionality of these devices will emerge into all of the other utilities that we have around our home, the other appliances, the bus that we take the bus that we take to work in the morning, the gate at the airline. The other things around us will take in the computing power. We may well just end up with something we carry on our wrist, or maybe even something embedded in us that tells the rest of those computers who we are. And then everything else is in the cloud and in those devices around us. And this is beginning to happen. We're beginning to see these sorts of computing devices. This is the Amazon Echo and the Google Assistant, the home, that you can talk to. And this becomes now the primary interface. You remember all those science fiction shows we grew up watching? You didn't see someone sitting in front of a computer terminal. You know, Scotty would talk to the computer and ask you to do things. Well, we're getting to that point now. And although this is really early days and still always a little bit awkward, this will, no doubt, become the primary interface. It will become more natural we'll be able to do much more sophisticated questions, ask our computing devices around us. And we're beginning to see these things happen already. This is the Hue application that controls my light bulbs at home. And when I'm approaching home, the lights automatically switch on, because the device knows where I am, has GPS, and it communicates wirelessly with my lighting system, and those lights switch on and off automatically whether I'm home or not. This is my thermostat. It has a proximity sensor in it. It's also connected to the internet, so I can change the temperature wherever I am. It will also automatically switch off the heating if I'm not home. Because it's on the internet, it can connect to my mobile device. My mobile device knows where it is, and when I'm approaching home, it will automatically switch the heating on. If I'm late getting home, when I normally have a timer, it will stop and say, okay, you know, Ed's gone for a beer, he's going to be home later, we'll wait until he's half an hour away from home and then switch the heating on. What's interesting in these examples is there's no human involved. These are machines talking to each other and controlling the environment based on their relative location. The glue that holds these together is geography. Okay. Maybe 5-10 years out for ubiquitous computing, maybe sooner. I, for one, won't be sad when we stop spending all of our time looking at these little glass mirrors. The new reality is that this is virtual reality, and to be honest, I think I'm in thin ice here. This is probably about the fourth time, maybe the fifth time in my career that virtual reality has been the next big thing. Not convinced it really is the next big thing, but who knows? Loads of people are putting lots of investment in virtual reality and in augmented reality. This is Google Earth for virtual reality. It works on the HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift headsets. Put these on your head. Very immersive. You have controllers in your hands, judge whereabouts you are. And you know, if you use this with Google Earth and you're not sick within the first 2 minutes, there's something wrong with you. It is that immersive. You actually feel like you're flying around at 5,000 miles an hour around the planet. It's an amazing experience. How useful it is? Not so sure. It will, I'm sure, get more useful. Augmented reality, I think, is probably going to be more useful. You know, an early iteration of this was Google Glass, you know, the thing that everybody made fun of. Never really worked for me because I've got a lazy eye. And they only made it to work on my eye that was the lazy eye. So it never really worked for me. But the idea is you put information in your line of sight that's relevant to you. It makes a lot of sense. In due course, maybe this will work better. There are applications like this that are emerging that are making use of, you know, those devices that we carry around with us, our mobile phones and our tablets. This is one from IKEA. And you can take any piece of IKEA furniture from that catalogue and place it in your house and see what it looks like. And you can walk around and see what it looks like from every angle. It's doing that because the device is quite clever at sensing its location, its pose, what you're looking at, and building a 3D model that scales to that. Here's another cool example of where you might use augmented reality. This is a train set. And, you know, all of us guys, we love train sets. And most of you ladies as well probably love train sets. Here's a virtual train set in augmented reality. So you see the guy making a road in his phone. It now appears on the screen on the floor. And his little robot follows the virtual road that he's created on the floor. It's a silly example in many ways, but it shows you some of the potential, I think. And there's obviously always a moose on the road. I don't understand that, but there you go. What's changed, perhaps, and what makes this perhaps something that is realistic now, is we've solved the degrees of freedom problem. Now, degrees of freedom problem is basically how well we can judge what you're looking at. Now, we've been quite good at judging basically whether you're rolling in either, you know, vertical or horizontal. So we can judge what your head's doing like this or like this. What we've been less good at is judging the motions to the side or forward. So we've not been very good at doing, you know, that back, forward, up, down, left, right movement. The sensors that we have in our devices aren't accurate enough. The accelerometers aren't good enough to do that. What we're doing, though, is adding to those accelerometers some artificial intelligence of recognizing a sea, recognizing walls and floors that give us that additional degrees of freedom. And that's really making augmented reality a potentially really useful technology now. It's also related to this idea of SLAM. Those of you that come from a geo background hopefully will have heard of this. SLAM is a technique that allows you to build 3D models as you interact with the real world. It makes use of stereo camera systems and lightweight LiDAR. But mostly now, just using stereo camera systems, so it's very easy to do. And I'm going to show you a video now of someone using not a standard mobile phone, but one specially designed, having these two camera sensors. But it shows you what you can do. Here we are. So you'll see a guy with his phone, and he's basically panning around the room. The two lenses are building up a three-dimensional picture, just using traditional photogrammetric techniques. And then you'll see actually what's being built by the phone itself. There's no additional processing involved. This is all done on the phone itself. As you can see, it's quite a complicated room that he's trying to build the model of. And this is what it looks like. So you have both 3D data and the textures from the photograph that you can add. Now, one of the big challenges of our industry has always been, how do you do indoor mapping? SLAM may well be a technique that we can use to do that. And it's also used in that degrees of freedom problem, because we can actually judge where the walls and the ceiling and so on are. Let's move on. Okay, my final topic of the future is here come the machines. There were, if you like, three generations in our industry, and I represent those by different headgear. The first age of our industry, 1995 to 2005, people wore those sorts of hats. And they came from defensive intelligence, or engineering, local government, knew what they wanted, very precise requirements, often not that worried about building quite expensive solutions that took many years to implement. Then, from 2005 to 2015, along came the hipsters. The hipsters were all about putting services online, building mobile apps. This is where your Uber and your Deliveroo and Google, in many ways, came to the fore. And where we are now? Well, there aren't any people. It's the age of the machines. And if you haven't come to terms with this yet, this is by far the biggest trend in our industry, without question. The others are interesting. Maybe we'll get somewhere. But I'm, you know, guaranteed that this is going to have a big impact. We can feel quite confident about this one. It's about processing, in one aspect. You know, it links into that idea of big data. But what's interesting is when you link the data to the processing capability of all of those computers that we've got online. So a huge processing capability now available on the cloud that allow you to do all sorts of different tasks. Now, what I'm going to talk to you about is Earth Engine as an example of this. Earth Engine is a service that we created that puts together all of the remotely sensed imagery that's available with open licenses on an online archive. So it's the whole Landsat and now Sentinel series satellites. That's at least a 30-year archive of imagery. MODIS imagery, which is data captured at a lower resolution daily. The planet imagery that used to be Terabella, very high resolution, approaching daily coverage. Now, lots of terrain data, weather and climate, over 200 public data sets, 5 million images, 5 petabytes of data at least. It's probably double that by now. The slide's quite old. All of that data is online and easily accessible. Now, for most of my career, I spent all of my time and effort just moving files around, getting data downloaded, doing some processing, moving them somewhere else. We don't do that anymore. All the data exists online, and crucially, the ability to process that data is in the same place. Should I do a demo? Okay, we'll try it. See what we do. me this was a mistake. Authentication is really, really important. Because who knows, I might have been someone trying to steal my details. Because I'm having to use this clanky old computer that you provide me with, as opposed to using my nice shiny laptop, that's why. Okay, so here we are in Edinburgh. I'm loading some imagery. Those of you who've done any remote sensing will recognise this as a standard false colour composite using near-infrared red and green. So red areas represent relatively healthy vegetation. Now, actually what I'm loading, I'll show you the code behind this. This is just a little bit of JavaScript. And what I'm doing is actually looking at all of the imagery that we have from 2014, 2015 and 2016. So 3 years worth of imagery of this area, and we've just overlaid them all on top of each other. So it's probably about 50 images we've all looked at. And, well, surprise, surprise, it's a bit cloudy. Who'd have thought? Okay, now, how am I going to solve this? Anyone got any ideas? How can you get rid of clouds if you've got lots of images? Anyone do remote sensing?
Just being shy.
All right. One of the things you might do is some simple image comparison and say, okay, in this case, we're actually looking at top of atmosphere reflected. So it goes from 0 to 1 in terms of the value that we're looking at. Now, the high values are going to be where the clouds are. So why don't we say, actually, let's look through all of these images and choose the image where that value is the lowest, because that's not going to be a cloud. Now, I can do that because in true Blue Peter fashion, I have one prepared. I can get rid of those comments and run it. And what you'll see is those original images, and then you'll see popping in newly processed imagery that's coming from that calculation. It's pulling all of those images, looking which one's the minimum value, and that's the one it's choosing. Now, imagine how much processing is going on behind the scenes to do that. And what I can do is zoom out, and it will do that same process at whatever scale I want to. It will take a little bit longer now because it's pulling in more and more images, but it's doing the same process. So there's the cloudy images, and then in due course you'll see the new images pop in that are filtered. There you go. Now, with that technique, if you look in Google Earth now, the standard kind of view of the world is cloudless, and that comes from this processing technique applied globally. And it would be something that would have taken, using conventional processing, somewhere in the order of 6 months to do on a standard image processing workstation. We were able to do it in 2 hours using Earth Engine, and it was using, at one point, about 10,000 cores, 10,000 computers to do the processing. If you want to have a go, all you need to do is to go to earthengine.google.com, put in your Google account, your Gmail account, and you can play. It doesn't cost you anything. It's academics. Have some fun. All you need to know is a little bit of JavaScript. Okay, let's move on. But when you really think about artificial intelligence, machine learning, you think about these things. This is a Waymo Firefly car. And if you walk around Palo Alto, Mountain View, you'll see these things driving around all the time. And what they're doing is training. They're building up data sets. There is a guy in the car here, but there's no steering wheel. Just has a big red stop button if he wants to panic. But basically, it's just driving completely autonomously. And this is actually not a geographical problem. The only geography that's used here is a simple sat nav, say I'm here and I want to get somewhere else. Where you use artificial intelligence machine learning is recognizing features that are generated from the scanning LiDAR, recognizing stop signs and cyclists and cars and understanding what they're likely to do so you won't hit them. That seems really sophisticated, but actually machine learning is much more accessible. This is where I live, in Teddington, southwest London. This is aerial photography. You'd all be familiar with that. That aerial photography is used today in Google Maps to create much of the cartographic content that you will see. That is my heat map of where I, as an individual, have travelled in and around Teddington. It's the same area. You can overlay it. And those red areas are obviously areas that I've been to most often. And I can use that data with the processing of that imagery to produce a new map. That's what Google Maps looks like. The building outlines that you can see on this shonky slide projection system, they come from the machine interpreting those photographs and extracting the building polygons. You can see some of the buildings are shaded in yellow. They represent restaurants, shops, places where people congregate. That comes from that cloud-based data of where people are being located. It's all anonymous, but it shows you where people are. The message here, though, for the cartographers in the audience, no human cartographer was involved in the production of this map. It's completely automatically generated and automatically updated when new information becomes available. We also use artificial intelligence, machine learning, to build address databases. If I want you to find out where this particular address is, it's quite a challenge, even for a human, to interpret an image like this and work out that particular address, because, you know, it's quite hard to recognise the street number. We've introduced a new range of street view cars that have much higher resolution cameras. And it makes the images look nicer, but it also means it's much easier for us to process that imagery and capture things like street numbers, names, traffic lights, business names, automatically. We started this process because we originally had to blur people's faces as a requirement for privacy regulators in Europe. You can see a guy here cleaning the lens. So it's not working very well there, because he's obviously very close to the camera. But think about how the algorithm works, how the machine learning works. We know that in a normal picture, the size of a face is not that big. So we wouldn't blur that big a face. We also make some other mistakes. This is us blurring the face of a horse. You know, some people are not that attractive, but you know, this is still a bad mistake. So we learn, we get better. We get better so we can blur people's faces, even when they are being particularly rude. But perhaps better that they do that. Okay, so we learn how to automatically recognise people's faces to blur them. That gives us real capability then to take that accurately posed imagery and the compute power that we have and deep learning to start to extract from all of that street view imagery really useful content that we can use in our maps. So what we can do is to use a neural network to identify things that look like street signs, because we can recognise the patterns that you know, street signs have. So you know, here's the name of a business on a sign, on the awning as well. But it's hard, because all of these street signs, you know, they're not like it's a standard piece of text. It's not like you're running optical character recognition on an article, because you know, we all use different fonts and you might paint them and so on. How do you build a system that will recognise all these different numbers and build up a training data set that you have some confidence with? Well, you can get your users to help you. You can use Capture. Has anyone seen this? When you've entered some details in a website, it puts up a photo and says, can you put in the number for me? And actually we're using that to build a training data set to teach our computers to be able to read Street View. So if you've ever filled one of these in, thank you very much. Much appreciated. And it allows us to do this. And this is what we come up with. So the green there is what we've recognised correctly. Casing errors are in blue, and where it's red, we got that wrong. But you can see that's pretty good for some of those difficult signs to recognise. And it allows us to go drive down a street like this and recognise all the businesses, and in the future be able to recognise opening times, menus, all of that sort of information that actually isn't available anywhere else. You know, there are no other databases of that content. If you want to have a go, if you know a little bit of Python, can download a library called TensorFlow. Very easy, import it into your application, and you can start to do machine learning. And one example that I'm just going to show you very quickly is this one. This is a Chinese fishing fleet going off. One of the problems about tracking illegal fishing is it happens in the middle of the ocean. It's very hard to know what's going on. There are some data sets you can use. This is AIS data. It's like a flight radar, but for ships. You can use that combined with satellite imagery to recognize where ships are and start to recognize the patterns of movement. Now, what does a fishing ship do? Now, an ocean liner will go from A to B. A tanker will go from A to B. Fishing boats, they move around. They come together on occasionally to offload their fish to another boat, and then they move off. We can recognize those patterns and produce a heat map like this. This is a heat map of where illegal fishing is happening, from combining all of those data sets together and applying some machine learning. And my final example is this one, Project Sunroof, where a problem here is to try and be able to generate an idea of how much electricity could you possibly generate from your house. And to do that, you need to be able to do it, obviously, for every roof, every pixel of the image that makes up that roof. Do it for every hour, because clearly the sun moves over, shadows are cast by nearby buildings and trees and so on. It's quite a complicated process. But we can get aerial imagery, we can create a digital surface model from that automatically, we can generate 3D models photogrammetrically, and come up with this, where you type in your zip code in the state, and it will tell you how much you're likely to save over a year by installing solar panels to generate electricity. So it's using machine learning in the background, and some quite clever geoprocessing, but it's enabling an ecosystem that allows other companies to go and install and build electrical solar power. And you say, well, okay, where does machine learning come into that? I can see how that works. Well, if you want to do it nationally, the only way you can do it is to use machine learning. Because you can do this now for every building in the United States. And at some point, hopefully, we'll introduce these techniques into Europe. Maybe never in Scotland, but who knows? And finally, I just wanted to show you a video, because this is just one of the funnest applications I've seen recently, and it combines much of the technology I've been talking about, but it's just cool. The human won, but the AI version consistently did exactly the same route every time, and it's only a matter of time before it gets better and better, it gets more and more reliable. And it's combining all of those technologies that we were talking about, AI, SLAM in terms of building up that model of the world around it, geography is every bit part of that, as you might imagine. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end. Thank you very much.
Drones, but that's not really. The ones that, that's not very funny actually. Who's going first?
Well, we can go for it now.
So Ed, I've got two short stories. I haven't got my glasses on. So this is from Wikipedia. The Luddites were a group of English weavers from the 19th century who destroyed wind machinery as a form of protest. The group was protesting the use of machinery as a fraudulent and antisocial form of technology. And it reads further down the page, just to cut to the chase. The Luddite movement began in Nottingham and culminated in a region-wide rebellion that lasted from 1811 to 1815. Mill owners took to shooting the protesters, and eventually the movement was suppressed with military force. I've also looked up on Wikipedia how many truck drivers there are in the UK. There's close to a million. And does Google ever think about the social implications of people coming like the weavers and smashing into Google data centres and just like destroying it? Because they see technology, not in any positive manner, but see it as destroying their very sense of worth. Their very sense of definition in terms of what they contribute to society.
Yeah.
I read also on Wikipedia, 85% of goods in America are shipped. And shipped around that country by, God bless their souls, the wonderful truck driver.
Yeah.
And I'm fearful that autonomous vehicles destroy the livelihoods, literally, but destroy, literally. There will be people jumping off tall buildings. What do you think? Is Google worried about the masses turning against your organisation with the same anger and vengeance that the Luddites did in the 19th century?
Yeah. I mean, this is clearly a big question, and it's something we think about a lot. We don't have a direct concern that people will be storming data centres and trying to burn them down yet. And I don't really see that happening. But we do absolutely recognise that the impact that the technology has more broadly on society. But it's nothing new. You know, it's nothing that has a specific grounding in IT technology or what's happened on the internet over the last 10 or 15 years. Technology will always displace jobs where technology can do things more efficiently. Now, once upon a time, every elevator would have a stool in it and a man that pressed the buttons for you that took you up and down. Now, we don't have those anymore because we pretty much understand how elevators work and they're largely automated, and we don't need to have elevator operators. We don't need to have telegraph operators because technology has moved on. What we find happens is that technology actually, when it displaces a particular job type, other jobs come along to fulfill that. And if you look at the number of people that were employed at the time of the Luddites compared to the number of people that are employed today, we employ way more people now that are economically active than they were at that time. Technology has moved on, more people are employed in different types of jobs. You know, autonomous vehicles will come. They are safer, predominantly. That's the main reason that most people are actually interested in the problem. Yes, there's going to be an economic benefit down the line, but certainly, you know, we at Google, we're most interested in the safety element because actually, I hate to say this, guys, but machines are better at driving than we are. They are safer, they're more consistent. It will happen. Hopefully other jobs will emerge that we will do that really make use of those creative things that we're really good at, that make use of the fact that we are social animals and we're very good at empathising with each other and we build communities. Many of the jobs that will be displaced actually aren't that great jobs. You know, most truck drivers, it's not the best job in the world. You know, they might love their Yorkie bar and stuff, but actually, it's not a great job. So, you know, these technology changes will happen. We need to be absolutely aware of that and to respond where we can, but those technology shifts will happen.
Thanks for the talk. So, I'm interested in that affirmation for the law. So, whoever wrote that algorithm, centre and find confidence in it and all that. I'm just wondering how, in the future, these sort of really smart applications, whether it's important that they're just quick and agile, or that there is also the balance with actually being rigorously tested and
that's a very good question, and it's very easy to sort of get excited by the technology. And you know, coming from a computer science background, you know, reality is just noise. You're not interested in that. Clearly, that can't work in these cases. So a lot of this stuff is ground truth tested. Actually, there have been arrests made based on this type of data. If you're interested in it, if you Google Global Phishing Watch, that's the organisation that's behind this. Well-respected, they produce peer-reviewed articles on their use of it, so it's quite a robust technology. Actually, what's limiting its application is that the jurisdictions of the various organisations responsible for managing phishing in particular areas don't collaborate very well and don't coordinate. So you now have this global view of what's happening, but actually on the ground it's kind of hard to deal with the information.
I mean, do you think that... in that situation, the application has been well tested. But do you think that there are potential for applications to be rolled out that maybe aren't so well tested?
I think it depends what you're looking at. I mean, this is, you know, trying to spot illegal activity, and that needs to be, by its nature, quite a robust process. But if you're looking at, you know, spotting patterns in other types of data, absolutely, you know, you can try things out. And much of what we do in this space is iterative. It's learning as we move on and collect more and more data. So it's very easy to start with a data set that, you know, you end up producing lots and lots of errors, but you keep working at it and you get better as you go on.
My question is about Capture. I read recently that Capture is basically defunct. Basically, Google can tell by our browser patterns that we are not robots, and you know, so it's captured now. I still need to put in these numbers when I do some things on play. So are we basically just being used to as Google's kind of, I don't know, pawns?
Sometimes, yes, you are. We've moved on a little bit from that. What you might see now quite frequently is, we'll show you some pictures. Say, in this picture, can you see a car? And click on the pictures that show you a car. And you now know what we're doing behind the scenes. So yes, we are absolutely using it. In a small way, we are. I mean, if you look at, you know, information about any particular restaurant, if you pull up Google Maps now and you look at, you know, any restaurant here in Edinburgh, you'll see a graph at the bottom of the page that shows you bars about how busy that restaurant is at different times in the day. And that's based on us modelling how busy the restaurants are. That's how far we've gone. We're very cautious about using that sort of data, because, you know, any location data is, you know, we have to be very careful in terms of personal identifiable information and leaks of that information. So we're very, very cautious. And actually, in terms of, you know, public events and so on, actually what's more reliable are the feeds that we get from local partners. So the city here in Edinburgh, or, you know, local authorities around the UK, they tell us, you know, if a road's been closed or there's a marathon happening, and that information appears on Google Maps from those trusted sources.
Google has a history of collecting vast quantities of data, but it doesn't always share that data. If it does it on its own terms.
Yeah.
Is that something that's ever going to change? So Google Books scans tens of millions of books and they're sitting in a data warehouse that no one can really access.
Yeah.
Capture data you collect is
Yeah, and in Earth Engineer, it's largely not outdated. It's publicly accessible data that we've just collated. Part of the problem we have is the increasingly complex legal regimes around data sharing. It makes it very difficult to make raw data available, because particularly information about location can, if you combine enough information, you can start to pick out information about individuals. So we're cautious about that. Where we release information, we tend to do it via an API, so we can control access, we can monitor how information is being used. And that's largely, I think, the way that it's going to work in the future. You know, if you want, you know, real access to raw data, you know, we support projects like OpenStreetMap and you know, other open source activities to build databases that you can go and play with and you can manipulate the data. For most of the things that we do, you know, we are always under the spotlight, correctly, for being, you know, the size of organization that we are. So people are, you know, always looking at how we are sharing data, particularly to third parties. You know, if you look at the standard terms and conditions of Google for any services, it makes it very clear that we will never pass your data onto a third party. We don't do that because it's the wrong thing to do, and also it's illegal in most jurisdictions.
The implication of that is that it's okay for Google to have all this data, but no one else.
Yeah. But if you look at what's coming along with the new GDPR regulations that are being introduced next year, that's the absolute requirement. You know, if you share, if I take data from you, that relationship's between us, and there's no way I can make it that available to anybody else without your explicit permission to do so. And that's right. I think that's the way that it should be. But it makes sharing data, you know, more broadly very, very difficult.
Thanks for the engaging talk first. Amazon is increasingly researching drones and deliveries, so I was wondering where to go with that. I know the cloud project, the Wi-Fi project, and private to collect, you modeled the samples and maps via planes.
Yeah.
What about drones?
Not my part of Google. There's part of Google called X, which does lots of fun stuff. They've got an old shopping centre that they've converted in Mountain View into their crazy laboratory. And part of the things they play with are drones. If you look, you search for Google X, you'll find the information that's publicly available. I have to be very careful because much of what they do isn't publicly available. But they are certainly experimenting with drones to the extent that they're annoying most of their neighbours because they're quite noisy.
Ed, thank you for a really interesting talk. It gets us thinking. As you know, one of my interests is descriptive geographical information. And one of the things I always say to the students is that while a lot of people are happy with a map on the app and all the rest of it and using that to navigate around, a lot of not so spatially aware people are much happier being given a description of the route. So go out through the big black gates, go up the cobbled street, past the building on the right, the building on the left with the Corinthian columns. The technology you're describing there is very close to being able to extract that information from your imagery and create these descriptions. It's presumably something you're looking at. How close are you to being able to do that?
Absolutely. And we completely agree with that mindset. You know, for most people, you know, we navigate by using landmarks. We use those as you know, a human way of navigating. Maps, for many people, are abstract and quite confusing, you know, even if they're rightly oriented. But let me just show you something very quickly. This might be quite useful. This is Google Maps today. And you know, I mentioned the fact that we kind of changed the rendering. You'll see that roads are much less in your face than they used to be. Remember, roads used to really stand out. They do so less. We focus much more now on identifying what we think are landmarks. And you'll be a good test of how well this works. So we picked out, you know, National Museum of Scotland, Surgeons Hall Museums, Dynamic Earth. We've got the Parliament Building, obviously the Meadows, Summer Hall. These are things that we think are the points that you recognise in a city as landmarks. And that's what we're trying to do, is to pick out those things that you would use to navigate by. And as you say, rather than giving you, you know, proceed 200 metres, then turn left, we'll say, you know, proceed until you get to the subway, and then turn right until you're halfway past where those big stairs are, and then climb up those. So much more human terms than the traditional.
So, we obviously had a new bridge recently across the river before. It took quite a while for people to ramp.
One day. It took Apple 2 weeks. Yeah. We did it in one day.
Well, my point was actually going to be that OpenStreetMap had it there sooner.
Yeah, OpenStreetMap had it when the bridge wasn't open.
Yes, I was just wondering.
That's not useful to people. We had it. As soon as it was open to traffic, we had it.
So it didn't turn it. I was just wondering how you do the detection of change, and if you do the kind of place to focus in on or.
No. OpenStreetMap is radioactive in our organisation. You mustn't touch it. It has to be kept in a lid by a box, you know, a long way away from anyone else, because we can't allow contamination of our databases, not with bad quality data, because OpenStreetMap is really, really good. There are licensing issues with OpenStreetMap data that we couldn't include. The way we knew that the bridge was open was, you know, it had an official opening date, and, you know, people walking across it and cutting ribbons and everything. But actually, we suddenly saw all these cars going along across the bridge, so we knew it was open. And that's what we do. We actually track people's mobile phones as they move around, and that's really good intelligence for telling you when a new road's open, or in this case, when a new bridge is open.
Can I have a quick follow-up question? Will you ever release a little bit of that data for academics to play with? That kind of
if you're really, really interested, and you have to be like really interested, there is a mechanism that you can come and work with us as a Google employee, and you can get access to the data and play with it as such. That's really the only way, because then you're not a third party, you're one of us.
I'm just curious about your statement there, where you say you're removing the emphasis on roads. You take away the roads off Google Maps, you're not left with much else.
No, they're not gone, they're still there.
But they're pretty difficult, as I found out today, going, bloody hell, I can't see anything. You know, it's all very well, I mean, I appreciate that the names are standing out a lot better now, and picking out the places of ID, like Summer Hall. But you've got to know where they are. And sometimes the sign there for Summer Hall, or the Surgeons Hall Museums, is quite small.
Yeah.
You don't just see a large building and go, if you don't go to the area, you don't see the large building before, there's Summer Hall.
No, you make a good point, and you may well be right, and we may well flip back and change. You know, our rationale is that, actually, this is a kind of a good general map. If you're actually searching for something, you're likely to type it in. So you'll say, actually, I'm interested in this Starbucks. And it will find that Starbucks, and we'll reorientate the map, and we'll label things differently, and suddenly that becomes really obvious to you. And if you want to kind of get directions to that, from my location, that's made really clear to you. So it's this idea that the map isn't static. It's really hard sometimes to break that traditional cartographic view of the world. But the map is always dynamic. We can always change how we render it. We can change what features we display to really focus in on a particular story. Because, you know, the basic rule of cartography is every map has to tell a story. It has to be for a particular reason. And here, you know, we have a map that gets you from where we are to that particular Starbucks.
That's great. It's a sort of big picture, global sort of type of view. If you're actually standing on the blue thing there, as I've had to do today, trying to get from A to B, I just went across the road and went up the wrong road. And it was only until my position changed I realised I'm going up the wrong road here.
Yeah.
You know, and I would regard myself as being probably pretty confident with maps, and yet I still couldn't read the map.
Yeah. And that's absolutely a challenge, you know, that's a real research challenge. It's that idea, okay, I'm here, but actually, which direction am I facing? The digital compasses, the magnetic compasses in these things are hopeless. Mm. Because, you know, they're trying to work with really, really weak magnetic field, and we're carrying them around in our pockets with coins and with other radios, and everyone else has got phones. It's very hard to make that work. So, research problem, guys. How can we do that better? How can we work out where you are and get your pose really, really accurate so we can solve those sorts of problems.
The roads themselves, especially in an urban area, are almost like unique signatures. You know, if you can sort of look around, you can very quickly pick up an idea. Just, you know, if you've got the roads accurately mapped.
Yeah. So here's a question for you. If you're in that position and you get the instructions, you say, says, okay, this is where we think you are, you're going to turn it. Would you be willing to do this before you started?
Why should I?
Well, if you did that, we'd be able to recognise the world around you and then orientate you very, very accurately and start to give you the right directions. What do you think?
Could be a good way of losing a phone.
Yeah, could be. How do we stop restricting the information that you get provided because we think that that's what you're going to be looking for? It's something that we do worry about all the time, and we do lots of user experience testing of the categories that we use and the prominence of the various types of businesses within those categories to exactly address that problem. Hand on heart, I'm not sure that we do a perfect job at that yet. I think there's still a lot to learn about how to do that well, and we may well end up hiding content. The thing about Google Maps is actually what you see on the screen is about 1% of all of the content that we actually have. We hide, like any card or cards, most of the information. And certainly when you give us some intent that I'm looking for this hotel or Starbucks, and we said, okay, that's what we're looking for, and we can start to extract that information. But when you come to Google Maps fresh, we know nothing about what you're looking for, and we make our best guess at the things that are important to you. Okay, I think we've got time for one more question.
Excuse me, stupid one. Thank you for the interesting talk. I wanted to ask you, so basically most of the services that we saw, they implies that the users have access to some sort of some technology, smartphone or either watch, but there are a portion of the world doesn't have access to such technology. So my question is, how Google is thinking to reach these new users, slash customers?
Well, it's not surprising. As a technology company, we want to make the technology available. We think it's really important, and we very much see for us the next emerging market for us is Africa. The next billion users to come online will almost all be in Africa. That's where the biggest potential gain is. That's where actually the infrastructure is in many ways not too bad. So in the cities, in many of the cities of Africa, there is good wireless infrastructure. It's expensive, but we can work hard to reduce the costs. But our aim is to make sure that everyone can have the technology because it opens so many doors. It gives you access to all of the things that we take for granted. It gives you access to markets, to knowledge, to learning, to information about the world around you. There's no shortcut. We have to make that technology available to people. It's about putting the infrastructure in place. It's making the devices cheap enough that they're affordable. You can get smartphones now with GPS in them, cameras, all the stuff that you would take for granted for less than $50.
Do you think Google would play an active role in doing this?
Yeah. Okay, thank you all. Thank you. Appreciate it.